From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Despite bad poll numbers and unforced errors on the part of the GOP, Florida Democrats are still struggling to find their groove between the center and the progressive left.
Even independent voters, even Republican voters, do not want, quote-unquote, safe corporate picks.
Also this week, we hear from the attorney who successfully argued the case for professors fighting Florida's Stop Woke Act.
Academic freedom certainly protects classroom instruction, and it means that classroom instruction can't just be overridden by politicians who disagree about what should be taught.
We'll also try to figure out what's behind Florida's sudden surge in executions, and we'll wonder if the FIFA World Cup will actually boost the number of soccer fans in the U.S. I'm Tom Flanagan, on air and online. This is Capitol Report and our end-of-the-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. State Democratic leaders in Florida are hoping for a reversal of fortune in this year's midterm elections, yet some in the minority party say electoral realities and potential party factions could make any statewide path to victory challenging. Tristan Wood has more.
Florida Democrats are running from behind. Republicans hold every statewide office and hold supermajorities in both state legislative chambers. On top of that, they also hold about a 1.5 million voter registration lead. But state Democratic Party leaders like Chair Nikki Fried argue there is a path forward, pointing to recent local wins and the broader electoral climate.
The Republican supermajority in this legislature is breakable, and we are going to break it this cycle. Since 2024, Democrats have flipped more than 30 seats across our state. That is 18 months of steady wins in districts that look nothing alike.
She says their plan isn't reliant on one statewide breakthrough, but having a consistent message of affordability and helping statewide and local candidates work together.
You break a supermajority through dozens of disciplined, well-run local campaigns, and that is exactly what we are doing. In 2026, we take this to scale. We build a coordinated campaign with our top-of-the-ticket candidates and run a ground game that lifts every Democrat on the ballot.
Longtime Democratic consultant Steve Shale says some state legislative success is possible, but he thinks the math makes the path to statewide victory more challenging, because Democrats need to keep a broad coalition of voters with differing views together.
Three things have to happen. Democrats have to be relatively united. They have to turn out at a good rate. You have to win independents now by 20, 25 points. That's actually not that insane this cycle, but that's sort of the math. And you have to win more Republicans than they win of Democrats. If any one of those three things doesn't happen, you're not going to win.
The front runners in the Democratic primaries for Florida statewide races seem to be playing to those numbers. Democratic gubernatorial candidate David Jolly is a former Republican congressman turned no party affiliation voter turned Democratic candidate. And Democratic U.S. Senate candidate Alex Vindman has taken a more centrist position in his primary contest against progressive state representative Angie Nixon. Vindman has a massive financial lead in that contest and a host of Democratic endorsements. The moderate as frontrunner in these Florida races come at a time when progressives in other states, like New York, are scoring wins. Shale says Florida's Democratic moderate leads reflect the state's makeup.
The median Democratic primary voter in Brooklyn looks nothing like the median Democratic primary voter in Florida.
But Key Lime Strategy's Jackson McMillan, a Democratic digital fundraiser, argues the party's assumptions about voters may be wrong. McMillan says the progressive success in other states show many voters are rejecting candidates they see as overly cautious and business-aligned.
You go on every Reddit thread and every Facebook comment section that's not an explicit Democratic insider circles, and you see that voters do not want, even independent voters, even Republican voters, do not want, quote-unquote, safe corporate picks. They want people who are going to advocate for working class voters. They do not want someone they perceive as safe.
Younger candidates fueled by progressive politics have cropped up in other Florida races, namely Elijah Manley and Oliver Larkin, who are running against Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz and Congressman Jared Moskowitz in South Florida. McMillan says Florida Democratic voters motivated by progressive candidates are at risk of not showing up to vote in November should their preferred candidate lose, or if they don't feel represented by candidates in other top-of-ticket races.
The reality is that voters do not choose one team or the other. They have one team that they like, and if that team isn't where they want them to be, they stay home. I call it football logic. Just because the Buccaneers aren't going to make it to the Super Bowl this season doesn't mean I put on a Patriots jersey. It just means I don't go out to the games.
But Shale thinks running to the left is a surefire way for Democrats to lose against Republicans. He pointed to the 2018 elections, arguing the math doesn't work.
Andrew Gillum, the most liberal person who's ever run for office in Florida, in the most Democratic year in my life, lost. You know, if Andrew Gillum can't win in a way more Democratic state, in a arguably way more Democratic year in Florida, then what do these people think the pathway to winning is?
And Evan Power, chair of the Republican Party of Florida and himself a congressional candidate, is reveling in his party's position.
I mean, the question now is not whether Democrats can play in Florida, it's how quickly no party affiliates overtake the Democrat Party in the state of Florida.
I'm Tristan Wood.
Now that part of Florida's Stop Woke Act has been blocked by an appeals court, professors are no longer under certain restrictions when it comes to classroom discussions about race and gender. Gina Jordan spoke with ACLU senior staff attorney Leah Watson, who argued the case for the plaintiffs.
We were able to obtain a preliminary injunction at the district court phase blocking enforcement of the law as a violation of the First Amendment right of professors. Because it limits their viewpoints that they can express during class, and also because it's unconstitutionally vague. It's not clear where the line is between permissible and prohibited instruction. And because of that lack of clarity and the lack of objective guidelines, that really just invites arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement.
So you won. It was a 2-1 ruling. What did the dissenting judge say?
Well, the dissenting judge took a very different position on what the First Amendment protects. In the dissent, the Judge Lagoa tried to argue that the First Amendment take an originalist view to the First Amendment. The courts are very reluctant to permit the government to limit discussion on contested topics to one viewpoint at all. But these are points that Judge Lagoa disagreed on. And really, there's a question. One question that came up during the oral argument was, where is the line between what the state can and should do? That was something that Judge Grant mentioned in questioning me. But Judge Lagoa, at the beginning of her dissent, opens with, we should be thinking about what the state can do as opposed to what they should do. It was just a fundamental disagreement about the role of the state and the scope of the First Amendment.
Interesting. So I am curious what you think this ruling says about the balance between having academic freedom and Florida having the authority to regulate taxpayer-funded higher ed institutions.
Yeah, that's a great question, and that really speaks to the core of what the court had to decide here. Academic freedom has traditionally protected the ability to determine what to teach and how to teach it. This is going back 69 years to Sweezy, which is a court case issued by the Supreme Court. So academic freedom certainly protects classroom instruction, and it means that classroom instruction can't just be overridden by politicians who disagree about what should be taught. Academic freedom protects the ability of academics to determine, you know, consider through a multitude of times the truth and how to have students grapple with the complexities of the issues that they teach. That said, the government and the state specifically here still have a role to play in the regulation of higher ed. There's just a line that they can't cross. And so in the majority opinion, Judge Grant spends a lot of time focusing on the traditional roles that the state has done, things like setting basic requirements for graduation, disciplining professors, even some core curricular content, like determining which courses to offer. But there is a line that the state can't cross, and the Stop Woke Act crossed this line because that line is that you cannot ban or suppress views with which the state disagrees. And the way that the law was structured, it just completely excises that from the consideration of students. For example, I'm a lawyer, and traditionally in law school, you professors will present a case, you'll study the majority and the dissenting opinion. Under the act itself, for a recent Supreme Court case, like the Students for Fair Admissions, the case that struck down affirmative action in higher ed, a law professor could only teach the majority opinion, but they cannot teach the dissenting opinions because those opinions disagreed with the vote. They diverged from those of the Florida legislature, and that's never been the case that the Florida legislature could decide, pick and choose what is taught in higher education courses and completely silence any other perspectives and foreclose the opportunity for debate altogether in higher ed.
It's an interesting argument. I want to take this a step further and just talk briefly about what Governor Ron DeSantis said on social media. He argued that public universities get taxpayer money, and therefore the state should ensure that instruction is without indoctrination. And he also called the ruling a judicial overreach. What is your response to that?
We've framed this law as legislative overreach because the legislature does not have a role to play in the content of what is taught in higher education classrooms. They've never been able to dictate what is taught in colleges and universities. It is true that the universities receive taxpayer funding, but that gets to the question that the court had to answer around government speech. And the state of Florida argued they presented a novel and frankly terrifying proposition that because they pay the salaries of university professors, they can control every word that is spoken in their class as government speech. And because it is, as they allege, government speech, there will be no protections of the First Amendment. No court in this country has ever determined that classroom instruction in higher ed is government speech. And frankly, the state of Florida said, well, it's government speech, but please don't apply the factors. There are three factors that courts consider to determine if the government is actually speaking for itself. None of those factors support the finding that classroom instruction is government speech. The first factor is whether or not the government controls the speech. And Judge Grant walked through these factors in the opinion, but the state does not control the speech of university professors. They're not, you know, in the weeds of what is presented on the syllabus or what is taught in the classrooms. It's not a traditional role that the state has fulfilled, well, due to academic freedom. And then also the remaining factors are whether or not this is a medium that is traditionally used to present the message of the government. And that's not the purpose of higher education. Colleges and universities are supposed to delve deeply into topics, inspire students to learn the relevant foundation and to understand the complexities that they need to address if they're going to continue working in certain fields. It's never been that higher education was simply conveying government messages only. And the third factor is that the public doesn't view higher education instruction as a mouthpiece of the government. This isn't something where you, sure, these ideas have been, are coming from the professors and the relevant disciplines, but it's not that the government itself has used this as a way to express its own ideas.
That was ACLU Senior Staff Attorney Leah Watson speaking with Gina Jordan. A Leon County Circuit judge today dismissed a lawsuit intended to remove Republican Congressman Corey Mills from the August 18th primary ballot. The lawsuit was filed by Michael Johnson, who's running against Mills in the GOP primary. Attorneys for Johnson told the court that Mills' qualifying paperwork was not properly notarized and should disqualify the congressman from the ballot. However, an attorney for Mills told Judge J. Lee Marsh that his client should not be kicked off the ballot for what he called a ticky-tack type of thing. After a one-hour hearing, Judge Marsh sided with Mills, saying a new state law on eligibility is focused on issues such as age and residency and less the paperwork process.
It's a democratic republic that relies on the people and their votes to vote for the candidate of their choice. And that is at the heart of our system here in the state of Florida and in the United States.
Attorneys for Johnson say they plan to appeal today's ruling. Congressman Mills, who was first elected to Congress in 2022, has run into numerous issues over the past several years. He's facing an ongoing House ethics investigation, and he had a temporary restraining order against him after being accused by a former girlfriend of threatening to publish sexually explicit videos of her. Coming up on Capitol Report, Florida tops the nation in the number of executions.
But this will mark the first time in Florida recorded history that we've carried out two executions in the same day.
And after the United States has been immersed in FIFA-style football, will the popularity of soccer really take off in the land of the NFL and the SEC?
They may come back in 4 years, but they are probably not going to be retained in the immediate near term.
One year after Florida set a dubious modern state record for capital punishment, the state is once again leading the nation when it comes to executions. 74-year-old Dennis Socher was executed this week at Florida State Prison, becoming the oldest prisoner in Florida to be put to death. And for the first time in 60 years, Governor Ron DeSantis has scheduled two executions on the same day. WGCU Southwest Florida In Focus host Jennifer Crawford sits down with reporter John Davis to discuss why execution numbers are accelerating and why it includes the elderly.
John, what is going on with the practice of increasing executions in the state of Florida, and why is this gaining so much attention?
It's gaining attention because Florida has been a bit of an outlier in recent years when it comes to the pace of executions. Florida was responsible for 40% of all executions that took place in the country last year. Governor Ron DeSantis signed a record 19 death warrants that year. That shattered the state's previous record of 11 executions in 1 year back in 1936. But for context, when he first came into office, his first year, he signed 2 death warrants. And then in the subsequent 3 years, he signed 0 death warrants in any of those years. And then 1 death warrant in 2022, 6 in 2023, 8 in 2024, and then that exploded into the record 19 last year. And it looks like this year we might be on pace to meet or exceed that number. With the death of Socher, his execution marked the 10th in Florida, and there's at least 2 more death warrants that have been signed. DeSantis signed the death warrant for James Duckett, the former police officer convicted of killing an 11-year-old girl in 1987. He'd been set to be executed on March 31st, but his execution was stayed because he had requested new DNA testing that he said would exonerate him. He's long proclaimed his innocence. Those test results were inconclusive. So now his execution is set to happen on July 28th, the same day Florida is already scheduled to execute 80-year-old Dominic Occhione. And if he is executed, will become the oldest person executed in the state of Florida. Another milestone, not just the age of the people being executed, but this will mark the first time in Florida recorded history that we've carried out 2 executions in the same day.
How does this increased pace of executions in the state of Florida stack up with the broader public opinion on the death penalty?
It's an inverse relationship. According to Gallup polling, they've been looking at public opinion on this for decades. Support for the death penalty in the U.S. reached its peak at 80% back in 1984. But if you look at the data, it's been steadily declining since then. Last year, nationwide, there was still a slim majority of Americans in support of the death penalty, about 52%. But if you break that down by demographics, that support goes down even less. For instance, the Gallup polls find that a majority of Americans 55 and under do not support the death penalty. This coincides with a number of factors, like the growing number of death row exonerations since the 1970s. More than 200 people on death row have later been exonerated and found innocent. Florida leads the pack there. Florida has exonerated 30 death row inmates who were found later to be innocent. That's more than any other state.
How has the governor's increased pace at this time really ignited debate about executing older inmates?
For context, Florida executed 70-year-old Dusty Ray Spencer for killing his wife in 1992. That happened in late June. He was the oldest executed Florida inmate at that time. until Dennis Socher, who was also 74, but he was just days older than Spencer. And now with the impending execution of Dominic Occhione on July 28th, he's 80 years old, so he'll become the oldest executed Florida prisoner. There are a few others older than Occhione who are still on death row in Florida, but it's kind of ignited debate that sort of goes beyond whether or not you support the death penalty, because it's about the efficacy of executing someone who is elderly. Like, opponents say, with an elderly inmate, the punishment no longer serves its original purpose. An execution decades after the crime is unlikely to deter future offenders more effectively than life imprisonment would. Some argue that decades of incarceration have already imposed severe punishment, diminishing the retributive value of an execution. Age and declining health can also be a factor. If older people who are suffering from dementia or cognitive decline, that might no longer reflect society's interest in punishing the person who committed the crime decades later. Now, conversely, supporters of this, who don't mind elderly inmates being executed, say the seriousness of the crime does not decline with the passage of time. And victims' families have often waited and anguished for decades, waiting for their sentences to be carried out, waiting for justice. And they know that these delays come from the constitutionally required appeals process. So they're initiated by the inmate, not by the state's inaction. And exempting people because they have reached an advanced age could create an incentive to prolong legal proceedings. Just try to keep the guy alive as long as you can, and if he reaches a certain age, they won't execute him. That being said, I think this does take an interesting toll, and it's something that's not really talked about. And this is aside from whether or not someone supports or opposes the death penalty. And that question is, does the rapid pace of executions we're experiencing now desensitize us to the concept of state-sanctioned killing? This is something that's just become normal.
That was Jennifer Crawford talking with reporter John Davis. For the first time since the end of 2024, Florida's unemployment rate went down last month. A report released today by the Department of Commerce shows the state's jobless rate for June at 4.7%. That's a reduction from 4.8% the prior 2 months. The rate is still 0.5 percentage point higher than the national average. Driven by increases in restaurant, hotel, healthcare, transportation, and warehousing jobs last month, the state saw an 11,000 jobs increase in overall new positions from May to June. The June numbers show 525,000 Floridians qualified as out of work. That's up 107,000 from a year earlier, from a workforce of 11.1 million. That was up 56,000 in the same time. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, after millions of fans came to North America to celebrate the game of soccer, setting record attendance and television ratings, what does it mean for the future of the sport in America? WGCU Southwest Florida In Focus host Teddy Byrne talks with sports journalist Kartik Krishnier about this Sunday's finale and if hosting another World Cup could be on America's horizon.
People are getting ready. They're expected to have upwards of 2 billion people viewing this finale. How have you perceived this whole tournament so far? And what are your thoughts going into the Argentina-Spain match?
Well, it's been a great success in terms of the crowds, in terms of people getting around the country. There were lots of concerns, including expressed by me, about infrastructure problems in host cities, how easy or was it going to be for fans, traveling fans, to get around? Would there be some of the political intrigue we heard that might impact this tournament, at least within the United States? That has not happened. So I think the tournament has been a great success for FIFA and for the sport of football or soccer, if you prefer. Going into this final, it's going to be very interesting because obviously Argentina is on this run where they won the last two Copa Americas, they won the last World Cup in penalties over France in the final. They have the greatest player arguably of all time in Messi. He's carrying them. They've come from behind, I think, in every match, it feels like, in the knockout stages, or have had to break a deadlock late. And Spain has won a lot of major tournaments in the last 20 years themselves. And they play
football in a very different manner than Argentina does. So you're going to see, this will be fascinating for American audiences who are new to this sport. You're going to see two completely different styles of play.
So now switching gears to the United States, who were not favorites coming into this tournament, but still had a nice special run. It got a lot of people going. I think I saw 30 million viewers set a modern soccer record for their match against Belgium. It gets asked after every World Cup, but do you think that there's any correlation between soccer maybe taking a rise up now following this year's tournament for, you know, fans in America?
I think there is going to be a bump. It may not be the bump everybody's hoping for in the business and everybody's expecting. I think there's so much casual fandom associated with this. And actually, if you add the Spanish language numbers, 30 million in English, if you add the Spanish language numbers to that US-Belgium game, it's closer to 50 million. I think there were 18 million viewers in Spanish. So you're at 48 million. And similarly, the England-Mexico game between English and Spanish, I think it was 22 in English and 24 in Spanish. So that got to 46 million. So two huge audiences back-to-back nights on United States television. But the thing that concerns me is that there's always sort of a drop off as because of the length of these tournaments. And then there's so much else going on the American sporting calendar. So the key is for Major League Soccer and the United Soccer Leagues, including the team FC Naples down the road from you in USL, to really kind of capitalize on the new energy, the new fans, go out and find them and be able to lock them to local clubs. So I think there's going to be a slight bump on both, but I don't think we're going to see all of the new fans stay fans. They may come back in 4 years, but they are probably not going to be retained in the immediate near term.
And then looking beyond even 4 years, all the way to 2038 there, where we know the next two World Cups are lined up, where they're going to be located, but there is this vacancy now a couple years out from here, and there are rumors that maybe the World Cup will once again come to the United States following the success of this year's tournaments. What have you heard in response to maybe that 2038 is back in North America?
Yeah, so my understanding is it's very, very likely that 2038 is either back here or maybe goes, if there's a combination of Western European countries that can do it. But it's more than likely going to come here in 2042. We might be looking at China. So the question for the United States, I think, is what will the host cities be? Because there are some municipalities and county governments that dropped out this time because of the expense. So that's, for example, why you don't see matches in Chicago. You don't see matches in Washington, D.C. Those are two huge misses right off the bat. The planning for this World Cup was so poor in many regards that FIFA themselves had to move a lot of people to the ground, on the ground here in the United States a year out, because they had to do a lot of things operationally that they were hoping would be handled locally in advance. So having learned that lesson, I think there'll probably be better preparation and maybe a little better understanding of logistically how you have to handle this if you're a local or state government or local county or state government. And in fact, in many cases, it falls to county governments more than city governments to handle these things, as we've seen with many of the host cities in the U.S.
That was Teddy Byrne speaking with sports journalist Kartik Krishnir. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, Randy Buxta, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Jennifer Crawford and Teddy Byrne. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.